Okay. Jackie and Rajib. So I came across your journal, Red Horizon, and was obviously super impressed. And then I found out y'all are on multiple campuses. And by you all, I mean revolutionary Marxist students. And you're also doing some really interesting work. So I've really been looking forward to this conversation. And why don't we just go ahead and dive in? Can you tell us a little bit about who revolutionary Marxist students are, what campuses you are presently on now, and then tell us a little bit about how you all even got started?
Yeah, sure. So Revolutionary Marxist Students is a mass organization of revolutionary students who are interested in the theory and practice of Marxism. We study the revolutionary history and also figure out ways that we can apply this history and theory that we've have a wealth of experience of to our current conditions and to the student struggles that are going on in many ways, and also struggles off campuses. We are currently active in Boston University, Columbia University, University of California, Berkeley, and University of Massachusetts Amherst. Somewhat of a modest appearance in different kind of campuses, but and also Tufts University. Can't forget Tufts. But yeah, it's sort of a modest appearance in different campuses. But we've sort of been evolving, I guess you could say, as an organization. We didn't start out obviously as an organization. A few of us have been involved in some of the campus scene, different campus circles and so on, organizing political activities. And we've been coordinating to some degree and decided that it made sense to start up a few different Marxist study groups throughout these different campuses, in the Boston area, in the Bay Area, and like generally in Massachusetts. And so we got started in a handful of campuses with study groups, just meeting up with different students every week, studying different Marxist texts. And over time, we realized that, we need to be combining our activities with the studies and actual practice that's going on. That's one of the important lessons we've kind of picked out from Marxism, is that it's not just the theories that's important, but also the practical application of that theory. And so we got involved in a few different efforts with students, such as anti-imperialist agitation on campuses, taking students off campuses to existing housing work going on that some people are involved in, and so on. And so over time, we kind of evolved from a study group to actually kind of coordinating on a national basis to form a national organization with you come across Red Horizon as something of a center of gravity for us to really kind of sum up our efforts and try to disseminate them to students more broadly. And so it really, so from this nucleus of a few different study groups on different campuses, we developed this national organization of students who are interested in revolutionary politics and are want to actively study Marxism and how to apply it to our current situation.
That's interesting. The first thing that popped in my mind was I just finished yesterday the first chapter again of History of the CPUSUB, and it made me think of, yeah, they moved from the propaganda circles to form the League, right? And Lenin was all about taking our propaganda and lending political leadership and beginning to agitate, which sounds really kind of similar to that progression of you all starting out as study groups and now beginning to try and implement the theory into the practice, which is cool.
Yeah, I think. Go
No,
ahead.
sorry, Jackie, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was just gonna say that also we didn't want to just like force an organizational form out of nowhere, which I think can be an issue on the left of people thinking like if we just have a name and a good structure, like boom, we have an org, like boom, it's gonna grow. But I think our emphasis was on like making deep ties with students and like starting to really build up that political clarity to necessitate people saying like, okay, wait, we should be getting organized. Like we should be linking up with other people. We should be expanding our efforts. And yeah, that we can't just like, decide that we've like declared it's now, we now have this revolutionary student mass org and like, boom, everyone will just join. So yeah, I think that historical lesson was helpful too, of like giving people the political clarity to see the basis to organize together.
Yeah, no, and that's a really interesting point that I know we're going to return to later on, but just to throw this out here, I think what, 2-ish years ago, I started like a tenant organization because I was really driven to start organizing, right? I had been reading and studying Marxism, not in an organization, but basically by myself or with some friends and stuff, right? For a couple of years, and I was like, all right, it's time. Finally, I have this chance to start doing some work, right? So I dove into something that I was we just got our asses kicked, and we realized that we didn't really know what we were doing, or have even like a solid grasp of Marxism-Leninism, Maoism. Then later on, most recently, I started a workers' organization, and again, it's the very same situation. So yeah, I think it's cool to hear folks who say that they wanted to actually have some political development before just kind of rushing into an organization, because I've recently realized, particularly within myself and some of my own friends and comrades, that we've had issues of just wanting to go out and start an organization, just start an organization and just start the organization, before even really having a grasp of what we're doing and why. All right, cool. So, one of the things that I wanted to ask you all about, just to get your clarification on this, is why did you all decide to be open revolutionary and explicitly Marxist, as opposed to having like a lower ideological basis of unity, which in some instances, could be able to reach, broader numbers of students, that quantitative reach as opposed to that qualitative development? And how does being specifically in the student sector impact your decision to, again, be revolutionary Marxist?
I think the main kind of driving reason why, and there's a few different ones, is that on campus, on the one hand, there is just space to more openly talk about Marxism because of the very nature of like the on-campus environment. People are already like reading Marx in class or have so-called Marxist professors. It's not something that is so out of the realm of like what makes sense to be bringing up with people compared to like other types of organizing where like you can't just go into a workplace and start openly talking about Marxism. Like that doesn't make any sense because of the different conditions in that section of organizing amongst the people. But I think so, yeah, on the one hand, on campuses, there already is just this culture of like talking about Marxism. But unfortunately, there's just such a swamp on campus in terms of like the different trends and different organizing that's happening, where there's all these different kind of liberal organizing groups all kind of trying to do different things. Maybe a few Trotskyist groups that front that they aren't Trotskyists, but then you talk to them and you realize they're Trotskyists. Maybe some eclectic academic Marxists or whatever. But we saw that there's a real void of real Marxist organization actually happening on campus. Even at campuses like UC Berkeley, where there's all this fronting about how radical the student scene is, or at UMass Amherst, where their school slogan is literally "Be revolutionary," yet there are hardly any real Marxists on campus.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God. That is hilarious. I didn't know that.
Be revolutionary trademark.
That's really funny. I didn't know that. Whoa.
Yeah, it's quite absurd. And I feel like the biggest issue we've seen on campus is not that people haven't heard the word Marxism and are terrified of it and are like, oh my God, like it's all these more subtle anti-Marxist, anti-people ideas, whether it be the stuff with postmodernism, which we'll get into a bit more later, where people just have this eclectic mishmash of all these different ideas, but call themselves a Marxist. Don't actually want to organize, just want to like pick fights with each other all day. And yeah, so the biggest issue wasn't that there was no people saying the word Marxism. It was there are really not many people genuinely interested in building revolution, and there's not clear enough political leadership that's just already existing on campus. So we saw that there was a void that needed to be filled of actually trying to build up revolutionary organizing on campus. So sorry, that's a lot, but there's a
No,
lot
that's
of different contradictions in why here and on this front, and why if we were going to go do labor organizing or something like that, it wouldn't make sense to be talking about Marxism just right out the gate so openly.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I mean, I've never done anything with student organizing before in the student sector, but no, I think I find it very clear, especially, yeah, with the swamp of, you know, revisionism, right? There's just, everybody calls themselves a socialist today. You have bourgeois politicians calling themselves socialists and portraying themselves, and people, you know, there's a whole organization called Democratic Socialists of America, you know, supporting bourgeois politicians and calling it socialism. And so it's really confusing to the masses when they start to hear socialism and they think just solely of reform. They are voting in some kind of thing that would ameliorate our suffering. And so I think putting yourselves forward as revolutionary Marxists and then help explaining and clarifying what that actually means, what it has to mean, if it is to mean anything for the proletariat and for the rest of the masses, then I think that's really cool. It makes a lot of sense. I would also think, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just to kind of add on to Jackie's point a little bit, that you have today a lot of people calling themselves revolutionary, quote unquote. You know, you have Bernie Sanders in the election saying that he was going to bring a political revolution. So in some sense, this word and these sorts of terms and all are in vogue among different leftists, different kind of student-y circles who are interested in politics to some degree and or another. So I don't think it's so kind of out there to be declaring ourselves as openly revolutionary, especially among students who are kind of at this forefront of different intellectual activity throughout our society. So they're more likely to be open to these sorts of things without being immediately turned away, like, oh, what, you talking about revolution? What, are you a communist? But, you know, yeah, it's because of this particularities with students, it's way more easier to present ourselves as revolutionaries.
Excellent, yeah. So how do you understand the role of students and the student movement, particularly in specifically a proletarian socialist revolution? How does your all's work fit into communist struggle?
Yeah, I think students are in a really interesting place in like the organization of class society, where on the one hand, you obviously have like the class background of your family and like the different factors that like led to you having the outlook that you have, though I think most students have a pretty deeply bourgeois outlook, and it's something we really need to struggle against. At the same time, they haven't actually like really fully decided, most students, if they're going to try to rise into the ranks of like the petty bourgeoisie and the bourgeoisie, or split and leave those petty bourgeois aspirations behind and side with the people and find different ways to engage in mass struggle. So I think people are at this really critical junction in their lives where they really can choose to take up revolutionary struggle and are really are definitely in a space where they're already being told, at least, that they're supposed to be thinking critically about the world. Though obviously I think what we're taught in college is reinforcing bourgeois ideology, but still people are in this very kind of elastic time in their lives where a lot is changing. And I think it's important to be really trying to build a new generation of like revolutionaries and people who take organizing seriously. And we can look historically at just the key role that students have played in revolutionary movements, whether it be like in India with the movement of like bringing students out to organize in the countryside while also still organizing on campus, or even in the US where, you know, I wouldn't say we had like a revolutionary situation in this country in the 70s, but the key role that the student movement played in the sharp anti-imperialist struggle and doing a lot of critical work with other sections of the masses like veterans and active duty GIs, where they really were able to leverage a lot of political power to resist the war. And I think students are people who are looking for answers. And especially people like our age, who were born post 9/11 and have seen the recession in 2008, the recession in 2020, I think young people are really disillusioned about the state of the world. And if we don't provide an alternative to that, it's easy to get sucked down into all these other self-destructive or just anti-people, paths of just getting some soul-sucking office job. So I think we really see it as like, how do we divert students down the right path? And that doesn't mean just like funneling them into RMS or making them like the leaders in RMS, if that doesn't make sense, but just how do we actually raise people's consciousness so that they aren't just going into the workforce with no real consciousness of what's happening in the world around them. So there's a few different reasons why I think we see the basis to be organizing with students, but yeah, maybe my comrade can build a bit more on like the historical context too around the role students have played.
Yeah, generally like students are some of the most firecracker energetic people that are wanting to get engaged in stuff and all new and shiny brains, you know, in a sense that they want to kind of learn about the world and figure out how to put this energy somewhere that's really productive. And I mean, we're all sold this illusion throughout our classes, throughout our schooling, that you can make a better world by participating in the system, you know, just move up or, you know, become a higher up at some company, and then you can make that company do whatever the hell you want it to, even though it functionally still has to run on profit. It has to figure out a way to keep churning more profit, to grow its power, to grow its wealth, and so on. But, you know, again, we have to provide that alternative. And throughout history, too, we see this, especially like Naxalbari, when students were going to the countryside to join the peasant uprisings and so on, and 1967 in India. And also in China, during the May 4th movement in 1919, where you had so a lot of protests happening in cities like Beijing, and that being like kind of a forefront of the struggle for anti-imperialist liberation, for national liberation for China. Mao even talks about in his speech, I think, commemorating what they called Youth Day, the May 4th movement, that this was one of the important acts, heroic acts of Chinese people, and really sparking national struggle against the foreign aggressors. So students have historically played this important role of sparking up struggle and inspiring other people to join up. But they're not just doing it by themselves. They have to sort of link up with the broadest masses that are part of these struggles. In China, you had the peasantry and the proletariat, who made up over 90% of the population. And today in the U.S., where the proletariat and other sections, like intellectuals, make up the largest part of the population, we have to be able to link up, as students, we have to be able to link up with the workers to really join in on the struggle for revolution. Otherwise, you know, us struggling as students has no sort of independent basis. And we have a class background, and we can't shape our class outlook. So what class outlook are we really shaping ourselves towards? Are we making it so that we're just going to the service of rich capitalists who are really out there for themselves and to shape the world in their image? Or are we out here to make it a better world for regular people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you help explain exactly why students need to play, and they will play, a very, very important role in a proletarian socialist revolution. But perhaps on the flip side, you know, why would the student movement not be the basis, right? Because that has been an error made amongst some groups, that the students are the most energetic. You know, they're incredibly fired up, and they're also at a stage in their life in an objective position where they're asking questions and they're open to really wrestling with everything that they've been taught before and how they want to view, you know, move on in the future. But yeah, so why would the student sector not be the basis as opposed to the proletariat? I think that's an important question just to clarify.
Yes, I think this has been a mistake made a few different times historically in the U.S. movement, where the student masses are seen as like the vanguard of the revolution. And I think it is actually reflective of some liberal ideas, like some pretty deep held liberal ideas that we see kind of groups on campus doing all the time, where there's this just hyper local view of the struggle as being mostly located on campus. And maybe we connect up a few different campuses, but we have all that it takes here. And while students, we've already talked about, play an important role in the revolutionary movement, they aren't the ones who are the main people engaging in production. They aren't the ones who have the main ability to leverage their role in the whole economic system to completely shut it down and dismantle it. Instead, I think they play a really important role in theoretical struggle and through building up the clarity of other students to side with the proletarian movement, but students are still not like the vast majority of the masses. And I think, you know, there's also a lot of varying class interests at the university, which there still are also in proletarian workplaces. But at the end of the day, the proletariat as a class, it is in their interest to overthrow the ruling class because of the fact that there's no other way for them to get out of their oppression. Or like a lot of the particular oppression that like students face on campus is things that could be solved with like liberal reforms or stuff like that. Like just the identity of student within itself in that position in society is very different than someone's like class relationship to the system we live in. That's how I think about it.
Yeah, I think the point about the reforms dealing with different kind of student struggles, like a lot of campuses have problems with graduate students not having adequate housing, having to pay a lot of extra rent, other things like that, different sort of reforms that are progressive things to fight for, but in themselves can be kind of tamed and kept within the system of capitalism. And a lot of times you can even buy off the huge sections of intellectuals and graduate students because they become appendages in many ways to the ruling class because they have to, their existence relies on getting those grant funds, getting the funds for research and so on. But this isn't the case for the proletariat. As Jackie mentioned, the proletariat in its existence continues to get impoverished. And in order to really escape this, its existence, it has to overthrow what exactly is causing that, which is the bourgeoisie's like infinite drive for accumulating more and more wealth, more and more private property. This just isn't the case with students by themselves. And so they don't have that sort of class instinct, even though they can link up with the proletariat in this larger struggle for revolution.
And also when you're a student, you know, you're only a student for like a finite amount of time unless you're someone who's stuck in like an infinite grad school time loop, like where at the end of the day, when you graduate, most people are still becoming workers. A significant section are also kind of these like petty bourgeois jobs. But as the economy gets worse and worse, most people are graduating these so-called prestigious universities and still working the exact same job that they'd be working if they didn't go anyway. And that's the reality that people face when they're out of school. So even then, like the student hat almost, I just see it as like a different social identity people take on. But like that class relationship to things is still there at the bottom.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is the base. And even though I think the vast majority of the petty bourgeoisie would benefit from living in a socialist society as opposed to a capitalist society, the petty bourgeoisie is not going to ever overthrow the entire, you know, capitalist system for the proletariat, right? And establish a proletarian dictatorship. It's the proletariat themselves who have to lead that struggle. And it's not the proletariat by themselves, right? The proletariat needs to lead and guide the masses in the struggle, but it's the proletariat that is the class that needs to have that leading position. So yeah, no, that's really helpful. Thank you for clarifying all that stuff. Okay. As I said, I came across you all through your really cool journal, Red Horizon. And, you know, through some of our back and forth email in preparation for this, again, you all have kind of got me thinking about my own and your language pragmatism. And as I mentioned earlier, right, my drive to just go out and start organizing, just start doing something. And it's better to be doing something than not with my little time, as opposed to gaining a deeper grasp of really what we're talking about here. So, yeah, so why does revolutionary Marxist students put such a heavy emphasis on disciplined, organized study and theory? You have two issues out, I think 8 to 10 essays or article. What role does theory play in the development of RMS? And are there any specific ideological or practical errors within the student movement in particular, or the U.S. Maoist movement more broadly, that you hope this kind of emphasis on organized study and theory will help kind of overcome?
Yeah, so just to start off, Lenin has this quote, without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement. And this quote captures the essence of why it is we actually study, because you need to have this sort of scaffolding, in a sense, to get an understanding of what exactly we're trying to do. if at a basic level, if you don't know what revolution is, how do you make revolution, right? It doesn't make any sense. So we have all this wealth of experience from back from the 1870s, back when Marx was originally writing his stuff, through history of class struggle in Europe and different nations and so on, and up until today. And you have the development of this theory, you have the development of our knowledge of how to make revolution, about how to actually engage in struggles, how to relate with the masses, and so on. But if you're just constantly trying to recreate that or rediscover that fact, you're not going to be moving past square one very quickly. And so that's why we really kind of emphasize that we have to kind of understand what exactly our lessons are that we've learned from history. How do we engage with that in a critical manner and also use it and also develop it? And that's a really important aspect of our own kind of development in the U.S. as part of the revolutionary movement, part of the student movement itself. How do we sum up different lessons that we've learned? And this is something that we've been sort of engaging in our own organization too, but also kind of doing that in light of the theory that we have. Like, pretend I'm a biologist. If I don't start from the basic level of, okay, what's a cell? What do I have inside a cell? Like a nucleus and all these different sort of like organelles and whatever. I won't be able to understand higher complex sort of interactions. Like, how do you defeat a virus? How do you strengthen your immune system? How do you understand the brain? And so on and so forth. Similarly with Marxism, if I want to study how to change society, if I want to study how to change what people are thinking about, how do you deal with oppression in society, you have to figure out from the basic level, what are we really dealing with? What sort of classes we're dealing with? What sort of sections of society you're dealing with? And so that's why we've developed this sort of method of rigorous study, encouraging students to take up studies seriously, do self-study as well beyond some of the study groups that I mentioned earlier that we meet up to talk about different Marxist texts. And our method of studying has kind of evolved over time. You know, we haven't had the same sort of study system because we learned, we made mistakes, we learned, and we kind of came together and realized, hey, how do we kind of rectify this mistake and also advance our work at the same time, consolidate our gains, but advance at the same time. So in the beginning, it just kind of gives you like a concrete example of these changes that happened. In the beginning, we had like ad hoc style, like circles where we assign a text before a meeting and say, hey, come out here and read it and let's have some circular discussions. Not everyone will read it. People have like different rates of interest. Like, people are interested at different levels. So you had some people reading the text fully, doing notes, commenting and stuff like that. Other people are just like, you know, I'm just here for talking about politics and so on. And so we needed to adjust this approach because we realized we're just at the end of the day, just going to tail what the kind of most backward students are advocating or tailoring the groups towards, instead of trying to understand what are the really deep confusions that people have, confusions that they don't know they even have. How do we kind of address these problems at their root so that we can actually lay a foundation for a solid understanding of Marxism? We came out, we had some debates, discussed nationally, how do we kind of rectify this mistake? And we kind of landed on this principle that we shouldn't just kind of leave it to ultra-democratic discussion to figure out what the hell we want to study, but to actually systematically explain things to students in a way that they can understand what they don't understand and also kind of build off that. And so we kind of landed on different leading comrades within the RMS branches who have a little bit more knowledge and experience studying and practicing Marxism to lead the studies and really break down to students well what these different concepts are. But this isn't a normal professor sit in the classroom style lecture. These are very interactive still, and they require a good amount of interaction with students to be successful in the first place. Because if we're just talking at students, they're not going to listen. I mean, they might absorb a few things, but you know, to them, it's just going to be uninteresting, boring class. Boring class they attend every once a week, you know, just to kind of sit through it. So that's really been an important shift we had in providing these sorts of studying materials, and it's really improved our ability to convey Marxism to different new students too, and not have people feel left out because they don't know XYZ Marxist concept beforehand, because we try to break these down and get at it in a way that most people in the audience can understand and feel open and want to understand. And it's really important overall. I mean, we have this culture in the US, like you mentioned, that it's pragmatism. We just want to jump into doing things, and it's all about the movement. Forget all this theory nonsense. But we want to promote that, yes, the practice is really important, and it's primary. It's how we develop our knowledge. But this practice itself isn't going to give us what we need to kind of advance the revolution. We need to be able to sum up these different lessons that we've gained over time through practice and really learn how to creatively apply it to our own situation. Otherwise, you know, there's nothing there to kind of build on. You need scaffolding, you need blueprints to build a building. So revolutionary theory is our scaffolding and blueprints to actually make things happen. And that's what we really want to convey to students who nowadays, unfortunately, are too busy kind of engrossed by TikTok and YouTube shorts and other things like that to really seriously take up theory. But there are people coming forward one by one, in handful and dozens, to seriously study Marxism. And we really need to kind of appreciate that and bring that drive out so that they can inspire more students to take theory seriously too.
Definitely. And I think the metaphor of biology is really helpful too, where we have to start at a cellular level and build up people's knowledge. But then I think the pragmatist approach is like, we're going to redo all the initial experiments that even proved that cells were real in the first place. And it's like, clearly through the organizing we're doing, we're going to reaffirm and see for ourselves that yes, this is, cells are real. They work in this way. This is how class oppression works in our society. We see it manifest in all these ways. But discarding a body of knowledge that's been really put through the test through historical challenge after historical challenge for 150 years and to just wave all that aside and say we need to figure out a new way. The new way people figure out is the bourgeois ideology that has been ingrained in them their whole lives that feels innate and correct and natural and pragmatic and sensical. And to ignore theory is, I think, to really just give in to the status quo and to say, like, no, the way I've already been taught to think about things is good enough, and we can just make a revolution out of banging our head against the wall enough times. So I think what my comrade said fleshed that out pretty clearly. And it is definitely a big trend we need to combat on campus. But I think more and more students are seeing that the student organizing they've been doing that is just, you know, endless campaign after campaign with no end in sight and no theory to guide them is not very fruitful. So we're trying to provide leadership and show people that by bringing in the theory, that's how things can actually get somewhere. And I do think people are looking for answers and looking for that.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I found interesting was, you know, you had mentioned like bourgeois ideology, and I can imagine there is a tendency to imagine that, like, yes, yeah, practice is principle, and we learn through practice, we develop our theory through practice, but, you know, we don't have to, it's not our own individual practice, right? It's the history of class struggle. And especially, you know, living in the United States with this massive weight of anti-communism, the erasure of our class history, or really just the history of most struggle in general, broadly, we aren't conscious of this. And so, yeah, I could imagine is that even when we begin, like I'll speak for myself, years ago when I first started to study Marxism, socialism, communism, all that stuff, eventually made my way to Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, even the idea of thinking that practice is developed, or I'm sorry, our theory is, and our consciousness is developed through our practice. I'm sure there was this long period where I had assumed that meant like, or maybe even unconsciously, that was my individual practice or our individual organization's practice, when really it's not our organization's practice. It's not even, you know, our country's individual practice, but that is the history of class struggle and the history of the implementation of Marxism through its stages. So yeah, I think that's really insightful for me, and I've been chewing on it for the last couple of weeks in preparation for this, and I'm gonna keep on thinking about that. Please, Rajiv, I'm sorry.
So yeah, I think you made a really excellent point in general about sort of our own collective effort and the history of like humans' collective effort in developing this knowledge, because there's this notion in our societies that there's this genius that comes up with things, and you know, they're the reasons why we have all these kind of different knowledge about sciences, about different practical activities, say cooking, art, and other things like that. But really, this is collective knowledge built up over hundreds of years of human kind of ingenuity, humans working together, learning from each other, and so on. And we really got to fight against this notion of this individual development of knowledge, a very kind of individualistic way. It's important for us to have this individual responsibilities to study these materials, to take it seriously, and so on. But us doing it alone is kind of saying that, oh, I can just kind of go at it solo and figure everything out by myself without actually kind of getting the insight of people or getting help from people understanding something and really developing my knowledge in that way. And we want to really promote this idea that human knowledge is a very large collective effort. It's only going to keep growing over time, and we have a role to play in expanding that effort too.
Excellent. All right, so what roles do educational institutions, right, like colleges or high schools or I'm sure other forms as well, play within bourgeois society? And I'm curious, what are some of the main ideological barriers that you all have encountered on campuses while organizing and educating other students?
There's a whole kind of swamp of different things that people are taught at educational institutions. But the guiding line through all of it is that it is all different reflections and manifestations of bourgeois society, even ideologies that might be in direct conflict with each other on the surface. At the end of the day, at the root, are most of the time serving the interests of the bourgeoisie to obscure and confuse the true nature of class society, to divide and conquer the masses, to fill people with hope and despair, or to fill them with magical thinking dreams that on their own, if they hustle and grind enough, they'll be able to make it out. And I think we can see different parts of the educational system like really inundate people with these ideas. But I think overall it is about, you know, utilizing the superstructure. So education, ideology, culture, arts, media, to reinforce the economic base of capitalism. And I think too, you know, like when we actually talk about that with students, we need to be concrete. Like we can't just be like, oh, the university serves the bourgeoisie. What does that actually mean to students? You have poli-sci classes where people are being taught the new strategies and diplomatic ways that the US controls the world and are being told that's a good thing.
Hillary Clinton just got a class in Columbia University.
Yeah, exactly. Like we're inviting the politicians and the exploiters themselves to come teach us, you know, their outlook on the world and how it's made them so successful. Then you have, you know, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, which on the one hand is incredibly important for the progress of society, just in the same way studying arts and literature and history is. But what actually happens when those students graduate? What employers is the university inviting on campus? Where's the money actually coming from to fund the research? A lot of times it's just going right back into big tech, the military industrial complex, into expanding the US's imperial domination of the globe. And even in science itself, the ideology people are taught a lot of times is this really rigid empiricism of, if you can't prove something with rigid facts and numbers and data, then it's not real. And it's this pretty undialectical view of the relationship between all these different types of research and study, and even just the structure of bourgeois university, where everyone is split into these hyper specific subjects that are seen to have no relationship to each other in the way we're taught them. And it creates all these divisions, and like people on the one hand being able to think quite sharply about some things, but being totally blind to other things. And I think also, you know, then on the humanities side, there's a whole slew of just downright revisionist, so-called Marxist professors, theory being created, so on and so forth. You know, look at all of the really popular kind of like postmodernist theory that's really dominating the university scene, whether it be like Foucault or Judith Butler or all these people, where at the end of the day, they can make correct critiques of bourgeois society, of the oppression that people face, even of like some aspects of how the superstructure works. But like Judith Butler in Gender Trouble, her end conclusion is like, we basically need to change the way we speak and think, and that will change the society, completely inverting revolutionary theory and vulgarizing it. And this is the kind of stuff that people read for class all day. But then when they graduate, what do they go and do with all of this eclectic revisionist theory? They go work for some NGO that's basically a tax write-off for the rich and the big banks, or, you know, maybe go be a teacher, reproduce this ideology, go to grad school, be stuck there for a million years, get treated like shit by the university while also reproducing bourgeois ideology. So it's kind of like, no matter where you go, you can't escape the fact that the university is trying to reinforce the social order as it is. And this takes a different character depending on where you go. But I think the rubber really meets the road when people graduate. And I think it's a pretty clear exposure of what universities actually serve to do when people can get all these degrees that have seemingly progressive content. And then all they do at the end of the day is go work for some charity that does nothing but put a Band-Aid on a bullet wound, or go work for an NGO that's literally just like embezzling money from a local city to do nothing about homelessness or other issues facing the masses. And, you know, for students, this is all very confusing because you're told that you're going to go to college to learn these ideas that will change the world, but then all you're being handed is dead end after dead end after dead end. So it's a real problem, and it does cause a lot of issues when we're organizing with students who are just so steeped in these liberal ideas that really can inhibit organizing in a lot of ways, whether it's this kind of like turf wars mentality to organizing where like you do your thing and we do our thing and like don't get in the way of our stuff, and like political debates are seen as like personal and like offensive, and like we just need to do this liberal thing of like pretending we all get along about everything instead of understanding that like we can still work together even if we have disagreements, but let's be upfront about them. Even just this like cancel culture stuff that's like, you know, such a heavy buzzword that people throw around a lot, but there is this ongoing trend in our society of this deep fear of like social backlash from like saying the wrong thing. And you can see it come up in the way students interact with organizing, where they've already been burned many times in organizing spaces. I mean, I have myself, and it just makes people want to retreat inwards into themselves because the social fabric is just like continuing to fall apart post-pandemic. And I think there's all these different factors in the student culture that we're just constantly trying to reckon with. But there have been a lot of glimmers of students wanting to work together and collaborate that we'll talk about more. So I don't want to like overemphasize the negative here either, but just to spell out the situation a bit.
Yeah, Jackie, that was really helpful. You started off talking about how basically bourgeois ideology is being promoted and it distorts, right? And it keeps us from actually being able to see what's actually happening in society, of course, on campus, but also outside in the working world, and then even beyond the made up country boundaries, right? In other parts of the world, how our country relates to other countries. And it also reproduces certain cultural values that keep us from participating in struggle and really grasping our position in the world and understanding how to transform society concretely. Because as you had mentioned multiple times, the bourgeois institutions are not afraid to talk about how to transform the world, right? And that's actually a main conversation that's had on college campuses. But it's really important for them to distract us from actually understanding what the problem is and what needs to be done to transform it. When I was in seminary, I was in seminary for like 5 years, and we never talked about capitalism. And I ended up writing my thesis on capitalism, and at the end realizing that I knew nothing about capitalism at all. I had spent, you know, years and years and years just trying to basically research by myself because none of my professors knew anything about it. And even though they were all very, very progressive, very, very it was a very progressive seminary. And so, you know, everybody was anti-racist and feminist, but nobody knew shit about capitalism. So, yeah, at the very end, I realized that seminary existed to prevent this religious institution from teaching like class ideology. None of the students I went with, and then none of the parishioners that all of my classmates were to go forward and then to help like pastor and educate, you know, none of them were going to receive a correct understanding of the world we actually materially live in. So yeah, I of course, you know, most listeners are not going to be in the religious world or, you know, in the seminary world, but it's really every single department, whether it's, you know, the economics department or the math department, the philosophy, history, all of it is really serving to distract and give us a false understanding of the world, but also a false understanding of how we can transform it. Yeah, would you?
So I just wanted to kind of quickly bring up a example from, I think, probably common to a lot of us who went through the American educational system in high school, that when you learn things in like elementary school, I grew up in Texas, so I went to the elementary school and high school, middle school there. But I'm sure this is common in other places of the country. You learn American history, and of course you learn it in a light that doesn't make it seem like, oh, you know, things were great, or, you know, the American colonists got along with the natives, and so you had Thanksgiving and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, it really plays down like Jackson's Trail of Tears, this absolute slaughter of the indigenous people here, the gross and really terrible enslavement of captured African slaves, and, you know, the formation of this whole racist ideology to justify it, which sticks around today too and affects the people and divides the people in that way. And all these sorts of problems are kind of washed from of their like real dirty, grimy nature and presented to us in this clean little bow that, oh, the founding fathers came here and established democracy. They fought against the kings and established America, and we have this beautiful land today. That's the sort of stuff that kids are being taught and are taught to think, yeah, this is such a beautiful land. I mean, of course, it's a beautiful country with vast amounts of wealth, but this wealth is controlled by, you know, just the elite, and they write their stories as the victors of over the masses, that we did nothing bad, and, you know, everything bad that's happening to you is because of your own sort of circumstances. So that I'm sure we can all, to some degree or another, relate to this sort of kind of washing of American history and washing of this through these institutions in schoolings.
Yeah, and that reminded me, just last week I was talking to an intellectual who's very interested in music and the history of jazz in particular in the U.S., and I was talking about like communist influence on jazz. And I really know very little about jazz. I just know about, like, you know, U.S. communism. And he was like, he's like, it's crazy. I know. He's like, I've never heard any of this before. And I'm like, yeah, there's a reason why we don't know our actual history about struggle. And Jackie, you also mentioned how your bourgeois society isn't, you know, just teaching us that, or kind of like misdirecting our analysis and stuff, but it's also like trying to control radical narratives, and so it's giving us, and it's promoting so-called radical or even, you know, so-called revolutionary ways of understanding ourselves. How do we transform the world? We need to like change the way we talk and think about our gender, right? They're allowing us to have African-American studies. But none of these entire departments, fully funded now by corporations, you know, they're not producing revolutionary proletarian feminists. They're not producing revolutionary nationalists that, you know, would lead to a revolutionary internationalist. And so I think that even particular departments now, that's a really important role that bourgeois institutions are playing in kind of capturing the element of the student sector that is actually interested in ending people's suffering, that looks around, that hates that we have roommates who who are going to live in a life of debt, or maybe they were unable to eat food a few times last week, right? Or maybe we come from homes where we just labor 50, 60-hour weeks, right? We look around the world, we see the suffering students do, and there's a desire to change, but bourgeois institutions are doing a great job presently, especially without much resistance, organized resistance, that it's giving us false alternatives to revolutionary communism. So revolutionary Marxist students has participated and led some anti-US military recruitment efforts with different groups and organizations. And this was something I was really particularly interested in learning more about. So how have you all been able to do good, like, united front work as Maoists, but with, you know, reformist organizations and even revisionist, you know, openly revisionist organizations? So how do we implement communist politics as opposed to tailing petit bourgeois politics and tactics?
Yeah, so I could probably start by giving a little bit of background for the anti-imperialist recruitment efforts that we've had on campuses. So some people might be familiar that different arms of the U.S. military, different kind of think tanks for foreign relations departments and weapons contractors and so on and so forth. These people come onto campuses, the CIA and FBI and other things like that. They come onto campuses and try to recruit the top talent for their next kind of batch of agents, engineers, other things like that, so that they can kind of continue to reproduce the system that bourgeois society needs to maintain. And so this is them going, like, kind of unchallenged is more of a recent thing. I mean, the 60s and 70s had huge movements against these recruiters and such, and where, like, universities like Columbia were able to kick off the CIA, and it didn't reappear until post 9/11. So a lot of these recruiters end up going unchallenged. So at a few places, we started challenging them in a sense by having protests and so on and so forth, and agitating against these different companies like Raytheon, General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, the FBI, the CIA, and other things like that. It's been going on in campuses that RMS isn't even present in, but with other groups. So we've been doing this for a while. With RMS, they started doing this in Tufts University and had good success in kicking out different kind of recruiters, scaring them to have their online events instead of doing it in person and so on, like these small little victories. And so we sort of adopt this as a national strategy to undertake as RMS, that let's agitate actively against these career fairs, because if no one's going to be a nuisance and expose these guys, then we got to be there to do something. That's one of the ways we kind of engage with the student front. And so we have protests whenever career fairs roll around. We have protests whenever different kind of arms of or different heads of the U.S. state or things like that, corporations like Megan O'Sullivan, who's a Raytheon person who sits on the Raytheon board, teaches a class at Harvard. There was a disruption over that. Different aspects of that. And we go and disrupt these events, agitate among students, and make these larger exposures about what this really system is about. If these educational institutions that are quote unquote supposed to be like creating a better world, but really are about funneling students into these terrible companies and reproducing this system. And so we're trying to bring different groups into this fold. And organizationally, our principle of unity is not you have to be a Maoist. We ask people, like, the very basic, like, do you see yourself supporting revolutionary politics, and do you want to study it seriously? Then let's link up and let's work together well. And because not everyone's going to be Maoist immediately, and we do have Maoist leadership among different branches and so on, but that's not our expectation. So when working with these different groups, our expectation isn't that they have to be staunchly anti-capitalist. They have to be against for the overthrow of the monopoly bourgeoisie and accept that accept our program. No, we have some principal kind of stands that we can unite around. Many of these different groups, they're for peace. They might be pacifists. We're not pacifists. We're for revolutionary warfare for the people. There might be people who are not quite pacifists or like anarchist leaning. There might be libertarians who are isolationists and against the war and against these different deep state elements and so on. And so we find ways to work with these people and unite with them on a principled basis that, hey, there's these things that we can concretely agree on. We can concretely agree on the fact that we don't want recruiters on campuses. We don't want XYZ company on the campus. We don't want to do, we don't want this happening on the campus. So let's work together and figure out ways we can actually make that happen. And at the same time, we maintain our independence as a group. So we put forward our program, the other groups put forward their kind of understanding of society, and we sort of let these things play out in students who are listening to speeches and students who are talking to us, and we convince the students of our own correctness by showing them in practice and kind of breaking down into these systematic exposures that what are these really recruitment events actually about. And so, you know, we're not promoting this liberal unity, oh, we're all in this together or something like that. We want to promote, we promote active debate and discussion among different groups about what our differences are, what are our kind of lines of demarcation, what distinguishes us from you, and what distinguishes your groups from other groups, and so on. So there's this tendency among liberal coalition building is that, oh, we're all just the same thing, we're doing the same thing, and when it comes down to actual disagreements happening, everything just explodes. They don't know how to deal with these disagreements, so everything just explodes. Because you don't have your clear lines of demarcation drawn out. You don't have your principled stands of unity where I say yes, I say we agree on that, and you say you agree on that, and we figure out ways to work together from there. So really trying to clarify that basic point about this united front understanding we have of, in Marxism, that we're about maintaining independent initiative and maintaining also at the same time working in concrete and principled way. And some of these groups, they're not very principled, they have weird people or they have weird politics and so on overall, but it's possible to some capacity or another to work with them. And I mean, historically we have examples of this, like during the Chinese Revolution, at one point when the Chinese communists were up against the Japanese to kick them out during World War II, they signed an alliance with the Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalist Party, and they were able to beat back Japanese, even though they were tactically working with the enemy. But they were overall, this served as an important step in advancing the revolution in China. At the same time, we're not working at this national level of the United Front. We're working among campus groups. Even amongst our groups, we have this sort of United Front framework where we're united around these principles of supporting revolution and studying Marxism seriously. And we figure out ways to clarify to students who may not be there at the MLM level yet to adopt MLM, right? Marxism, Leninism, Maoism. So it's really that kind of principle we apply to this, to our own organization as a mass organization and among these different efforts on campuses to unite with different groups. And it's been quite successful in mobilizing different groups that they see, oh, wow, these people want to do something. They want to figure out ways to concretely work together. Let's do it. And we've had a lot of people come on board for, not a lot, but like, you know, we had a good amount of people come on board for, because like student mobilization is fairly limited, even though it's coming up more and more. But we've had some success trying to get people together for this anti-imperialist recruitment campaign that we have going. We can share some more information about that. But it's like a huge petition campaign we're trying to carry out across different campuses. We have like just to list a few universities: Boston University, Columbia, Barnard, Cornell, Boise State, University of Maryland, all of our RMS campuses, and all these other different groups. So just to give you a sense that it's been possible to work with these different groups and that we don't have to kind of close ourselves off, even though some of the leadership is Maoist and some of the people who are involved are revolutionaries and so on. That's not our sort of unity of basis of unity for these groups and for these anti-imperialist campaigns.
Yeah, and this takes me back to the earlier point about like grasping theory for correct practice, because you all, Rajib, you really just like demonstrated what a correct understanding of the United Front is from a Maoist perspective. Because you can make a rightist error, and as you were saying, have this like liberal approach where you might call yourself, you know, revolutionary, you might talk about Maoism or whatever, but you end up just tailing and following all the other organizations, whether they are just like politically, you know, more out front, or maybe they have larger numbers. But you, like I said, you just end up being a part of a big group and you avoid struggle. so that you just maintain a very, very low level of unity. But then there's this left error, a left opportunist understanding of United Front, if you would, where you only participate in stuff where you can kind of control it and you kind of command everything and you make sure that you say, basically, this is our United Front. And if you want to be in it, then you have to do whatever we do. When really what I hear you saying is that it's very principled. First of all, you are, you know, I think it's really key to know, as you said, that there's a very low level, a relatively low level of struggle presently today. But you all, as conscious as you are, you're seizing on an opportunity. You're seizing on a moment and you're asserting particular politics. You're uniting with people on a political basis while also acknowledging the differences, and not just acknowledging, but also engaging in struggle, I'm sure, whether that be through conversation, through planning, at the actual events. But you're saying, you know, we don't want to avoid these differences. We think these differences are important. We want to engage these, but we also need to unite on these specific things, and we can and we must. So I think that's it's really, really interesting to hear about your experience actually practicing the United Front.
It's really easy, I think, to get disillusioned with the campus organizing spheres and be like, that's it. We're not engaging with any of these groups. It is such a swamp. This is horrible. And I think that's like an error we've fallen into, definitely, of not really seeing the importance actually of trying to work with people where we can. And I also think the point raised about RMS being a mass organization actually means that you know, we don't have this like checklist of like qualifications that someone needs to meet to join RMS. Like RMS is like a group that is open to all students. There's not some like weird, like, I don't know, like you have to be read enough or something to join. Like, and that has been really important to us being able to meet students where they're at and really bring in and develop people. And in the same way, you know, you can't ham-fist United Front into happening around politics that people don't see the basis to unite on. And that doesn't mean we organize around things that are backwards or not helpful to the revolutionary movement. But if we aren't finding ways to work with people who aren't communists, we won't be able to make a revolution in this country. Just at a basic level, we are a vast minority of the political schema in the US. And it will still continue to be that way, even up to a revolutionary situation. But what's really important is how can we work with large sections of the masses who do see the basis to change society, even if there are different contradictions and different backwards ideas in different places. Like, how do we work with people where they're at? And it reminds me of in State and Revolution, Lenin has this really good quote, basically just saying that like, anarchists don't want to change society with like the people that we have now. They just assume that like we can only have a better society with like better people where everyone's perfect and we could just instantly abolish everything and that we'll be able to go straight to communism. And instead that socialists, we actually have to really dive deep into where people are at, where the masses are at, where are the struggles that are happening? Where can we move things forward? And we can't just have this fantasy that one day everyone's going to wake up and fully have a deep scientific understanding of the world and a clear understanding of the need for revolution. Like, that's never just going to magically appear. And I think if we're not doing United Front work, it's going to be pretty hard to move a bigger revolutionary movement forward.
Yeah. In other words, the United Front is a struggle front in itself. So we have to be able to continue that struggle there and struggle against different class ideas, struggle for leadership. But that struggle for leadership means that our leadership can't be absolute. It's only something that we can maintain as long as we're struggling for it. And different class ideas are going to also struggle for petty bourgeois. Even outright bourgeois might try to infiltrate and disrupt their activities or struggle for co-optation and things like that. But we need to be kind of vigilant and ready to struggle it out whenever it does need to happen. And it should be happening on a regular basis. So yeah, really kind of discarding these notions that we can kind of set the rules and boundaries for this United Front and expect people to come join us. Because people, as Jackie was saying, we don't have the perfect ideal human here. We're working with humans as they exist in our society and figuring out how do we transform and evolve these humans so that we can work on a higher and more democratic and then on a communist level, you know, after revolution, after the proletariat seizes power. And this sort of struggle is just going to continue going on for transformation in socialist society. It's going to intensify in socialist society until we reach communism, and there's new contradictions that are going to arise. But still, like, that's like the only thing that's constant is this change and the struggle for change.
Yeah, absolutely. And socialism, you know, it's only possible when the proletariat themselves have developed proletarian consciousness. And that's the kind of work that I hear you all doing. And so how does, you know, developing the proletarian socialist consciousness relate to, you know, getting students involved in struggle?
Without having any sort of like real revolutionary class consciousness, I think it is really hard to combat all the negative tendencies we've already talked about on campus, of people seeing the immediate thing right in front of them, their own subjective situation as the entire world, as the entire struggle. And it's really easy to get disheartened when you see the entire political struggle as just what's happening on campus, because the campus scene is in a pretty low place right now. And I think getting students off of campus and out amongst different sections of the masses, because students are also part of the masses, but different sections of the masses, can first of all give people a lot more hope of like, oh, when there's like all this beef happening on my campus organizing space, this is like a very small nucleus of like a much broader struggle. But also just actually really integrating themselves amongst the people is so important to combating all these petty bourgeois ideas that people get drilled into their heads all day. Because, you know, you can sit around in class all day and have these, you know, high level intellectual debates about nothing, but then actually go try to talk to people who haven't been to college about what are they facing, what do they actually think about the world? What do they think about the political system? You can't just like start blabbing like postmodern slogans at sections of the masses. Like, it will not resonate with anyone. People will be like, who is this freak? Why are you talking to me about like the viscous porosity between like being and doing or whatever? Like that doesn't work. And I think just like going amongst the people, all different sections of the masses, whether it be tenants in public housing, whether it be workers in a variety of different workplaces, you know, whether it be just like even different sections of the masses organized around certain like social causes, like that's what allows students to like really expand their worldview and understand what it means to be like serving the people and going amongst the people. And if you're just stuck in these student spaces where it's, you're really encouraged to like think a certain way and otherwise you will be kicked out of the in-group, it can really stifle people's ability to develop politically. And I think really getting out and trying to talk to people in a whole variety of different ways helps open up students' minds more to having a more complex picture of American society and what are the pressing questions facing the people that we need to be working with them on. But at the same time, it's not to say that the struggle that happens on campus doesn't matter or doesn't make any sense to be struggling on that front either. I think having like a good balance of students engaging with struggle on campus where they have already pretty deep links in a variety of ways and are in a real position to provide leadership alongside starting to meet members of the masses in other areas and other types of organizing that they haven't done before is a really helpful mix of like building someone's overall theoretical development. I know for Ajib and I, it's been really important to be engaging in kind of organizing on and off campus to have a better understanding of what's facing all different sections of the masses across society. And without organizing amongst the people, it's hard to convince people that they should do off-campus organizing when they graduate too. So I think it's good to already have people thinking about themselves as someone who could be doing organizing, engaging politically outside of just their identity as a student.
Yeah, and I would think that by participating in struggle in multiple sites as a student, you'd gain a greater insight into like who the enemy is and how the enemy is actually exploiting and oppressing in different classes and different strata within the various classes. So absolutely, I think there's a lot to gain there.
This is one of the things that actually Lenin talks about in What Is to Be Done, is that we as revolutionaries should be taking up all these different kind of torrents, these different kind of struggles, these outrages in society, concentrating them and turning them into one stream of oppression or one stream of like resistance that we can kind of aim at the ruling class. And as students, we have that ability, we have the time to think about these things, we have the time to engage with these other struggles going on and try to really show people how these are integrally linked. And so getting off campus can really highlight that. And I mean, today, nowadays, you're seeing this trend where, not trend, but it's like this kind of change that's happening where there's a lot more interest in labor organizing, especially among students. Like before, back in the day, I wasn't here when it was not popular, but I heard from older comrades that actually, if you ask people to go off campus, I mean, they'd say, oh, yeah, it sounds like a good idea. Or enter into a workplace for labor organizers. Oh, that sounds like a good idea. But then when it came down to it, they weren't really interested in doing that. But nowadays, people are entering into these workplaces, getting organized, and we kind of want to promote that spirit within students. That, hey, what's this career that this bourgeois institution is creating for you, and what does it actually mean? Why don't you, you know, since you're involved in this activism stuff, join the struggle off campus after you graduate. Think about what life is after graduation. Serving the people, serving to advance revolution in this country. And it's one of the things that I think the comrades in India figured out pretty early on, back in the 70s, actually, when in India there was this period where the government imposed this called emergency, it was basically a tactic to wipe out all sorts of like resistance, all sorts of so you had a lot of peasant struggles going on, you had armed struggle against the state. It was kind of a blanket measure to like shut down everything and enforce martial law so that they can kind of wipe out any sort of resistance there was to the government, ranging from like really fascist Hindutva forces all the way to like left-wing Naxalbari like Maoists who were fighting against the oppressors. So during this like blanket repression period of martial law, you had a lot of revolutionary students who had to go underground because they were sympathetic to the revolutionary movement, they were sympathetic to land reform and other things like that. So what happened when these students had to go off, had to go underground? They went straight into the countryside, to the forest, to study the lives of the peasantry, to join in their struggles, and to continue to really figure out how do we change Indian society and revolutionize it. And so they gained a lot of experience from that and kind of crystallized that into a program where they would send students to the countryside during breaks, and they would come back to the cities whenever they had like the regular semester or the regular term in session, and they do their campus struggles and do a little off-campus organizing as well. But when it was break time, they'd all go back into the countryside to do reports, do research, contribute to the advancing the revolution. And we really took that, and we were inspired by that in some regards, because we did an interview, RMS, of one of the revolutionaries that emerged from that kind of period of emergency and going to the countryside. It's available on our YouTube channel too if people are interested. But really, we took that kind of lesson and we were like, this makes sense, and we've been applying it to inspire more students to kind of link up and join the efforts for advancing revolution in this country through different struggles.
Excellent. Yeah. So you mentioned that you have different material, some stuff on YouTube, but the main bulk of your kind of like the theory that you're producing is through Red Horizon, your journal. So to wrap up this conversation, again, thank you so much, both Jackie and Rajib, for speaking with me tonight and sharing everything that you all have shared with us. But yeah, I want to return to the role of Red Horizon that plays within your organization. So why Red Horizon, and what's the intent behind it?
I mentioned a little earlier that, you know, we might have some revolutionary theory, but what do we do with it exactly? And how do we establish as national organization some sort of principles that we can kind of agree on and politics that we can clarify to our larger organization? Because there's going to be differing levels of understanding of revolutionary theory among different members, and even among the masses at large, the student masses at large, who have these different questions. What is Marxism? What is communism? What are all these theories about? What about identity politics? That sounds like a good solution for different problems. What about making reforms? Other things like that. And you sort of need, with any sort of organization, a center of gravity for laying out its theoretical, its various principles. And that's what we sort of aim to do with Red Horizon is, one, have that basic kind of frame of reference or center of gravity for where our different ideas emanate from. And two, there's these different principles we want to really highlight to people that these are things that we really agree on. We want to perpetuate it across students and across the masses at large. And overall, I mean, it's not too hard to look around, ask a few people, and see that people are deeply confused about what it is. They see a lot of different problems. They see inflation. They see banking crises. They see unemployment. They see ramping up wars, environmental disasters, racism, police brutality, all these sorts of issues, but have no way of kind of coherently synthesizing that up. And then this is especially true among students, where you have like different solutions, like for racism, let's just change the way we talk and then, you know, racism is fixed, or do these things like land acknowledgments where you say, oh, we're on so-and-so former unceded indigenous territory. Okay, but that really doesn't help give any sort of leeway in developing material conditions that, or preventing the recreation of the material conditions that have gave rise to all these sorts of oppression and oppressive ideas and so on. What does land acknowledgements do? What is changing the way we use either Black, African-American, other things like that actually do at the end of the day if we're not dealing with the concrete issue of racism and the concrete inequalities that they have? And really all these sorts of problems we want to overall clarify to students. At the same time, dealing with these different confusions that people have, really put forward our basic orientation as what we should do as students. I mean, I mentioned earlier that we want to connect up, and Jackie explained that in detail, we want to connect up this notion of students getting off campus and the revolutionary movement overall. But how do we kind of solidify that connection and really propagate it to people? You have to have some sort of written material. You have to have some sort of medium of kind of clarifying that. And so that's been really important of a role that Red Horizon has played. Another thing, of course, is getting in touch with other people, other students who are interested, even in touch with people who are more revolutionary minded, that are interested in exchanging ideas and so forth. Because we can't say we have the perfect ideas, because no one has the perfect ideas. We're limited by our own sort of subjectivity. So having these sorts of mechanism for getting and receiving criticism from the outside, Red Horizons is an excellent way to kind of receive that and refines our own ideas about Marxism. And so having that sort of system to publish our material, to publish our ideas, also receive feedback for what we're putting forward and establish sort of a more firm grounding for students who may be newer to Marxism in a more introductory way, even members of the masses who may not have any sense of what Marxism is but are interested in study, they can take up these materials like Red Horizon to study it and have like an introductory material to open them up to the world of really tons of knowledge that's available through us to us through all these sorts of Marxist texts and so on.
Well, Jackie and Rajib, I really appreciate speaking with you all. I've learned so much from you, and I'm sure I'm going to continue to learn as I continue to follow revolutionary Marxist students. So, and you all have mentioned that you don't have to be, you know, this years-long studied Maoist to join revolutionary Marxist students today. So how can people across the U.S. connect with you all, maybe even link up with you all on campus?
Yes, we just encourage folks to reach out to us. Our Instagram is Marxist_students. And then our website, I think, is revolutionarymarxiststudents.wordpress, unless I'm wrong about that.
Marxiststudents.wordpress.com.
Sorry, but yeah. All the links will be in the show notes, I assume. But
yeah, definitely.
If people are interested in RMS, just shoot us an email. We'd love to call if people are interested in trying to set up a chapter on their campus or want to link up with chapters that are already developed. We're definitely down to talk to people from all over the U.S. and even internationally too, about what does it look like to be building up more revolutionary organization on campus. And it would be great to hear from anyone who's interested, as I know your listenership has a lot of folks who are probably looking for ways to tap in, and maybe there isn't so much where they are, but they could definitely start something up.
Yeah, and just like as a reminder, we are at currently Boston University, Tufts University, Columbia University, University of Massachusetts, Amherst, and University of California, Berkeley.
Boom! Yeah, you got them all. Right on. Excellent. Well, thank you, comrades. I really appreciate you. And like I said, thank you for your...
Oh, one more thing.
Yeah, please.
Sorry, I forgot. So we do have this petition campaign too. If you are interested in joining it, you can reach out to us. noimperialistrecruitment.wordpress.com. Everything's on there.
Right on, yeah. And we'll link all that in the show notes. All right. Peace, comrades.
Thank you.
Thank you.